This year is brought to you by Eshel Publications. Eshel Publications is a non-profit organization dedicated to spreading the Torah, Shiurim, and Sefarim of Rabbi Aaron Lapiansky. For sponsorships or more information, visit eshelpublications.com.
It is a very, very big cover for our yeshiva, and took a little bit of maneuvering on the yeshiva's part and on our part to make sure this happened, but we really wanted to make sure that we as yeshiva had the opportunity to hear from Rav Aaron Lapiansky. I don't know the Rav very well, but I could say that I am a secret admirer in terms of Ben Torah for Life is one of my favorite Sfarim out there, and just the Hashkafa and the online Shiurim and just getting a glimpse of what real Godless Batorah is, and a clarity of thought and a clarity of Hashkafa. And I'll say at the same time, in a world that's very, very extreme, a real sense of normalcy. And it's not my place to say that, but to have a Gadol HaTorah who's so well thought through, and to be able to host Rebbe in our yeshiva. And I know we share Tamid, and we've had boys from here go to back to Silver Spring to learn there. It's a beautiful partnership, and we're very, very honored to have Rav Aaron Lapiansky with us this morning.
Thank you.
It's very nice to be here. As Yeshiva said, we share a lot of Talmidim, especially the Mashkiach today in Yeshiva is an old alumnus here, quite a few years ago. And Baruch Hashem, it's been a very, very wonderful relationship. Bochum came here and got this chazik. Bochum, form was right place, came and continued to grow. And Mitz Hashem, Torah should continue to flourish everywhere here. It's here in Tetzit Torah, and Torah should spread its wings everywhere. I came in and saw the wonderful program. I was looking at the rewards. I was tempted maybe to stay around. You know, not many. You don't get many offers like that in all of my yeshivas. You know, it's quiet. It looks enticing. But I think it's worth speaking a few minutes about it, because it's a lot more than just increasing hasmada and learning many more hours. Yes, a product of it is that we learn more hours and we learn a lot more, and a lot of hasmada and transruach. Those are wonderful things. But I think there's something to the core of a program like this that is a different quality of learning. And I want to talk about this because I think this is something that should create a perspective on how you go about learning in general. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that if somebody is misnamnim in the Beis HaMedrash, if somebody falls asleep in the Beis HaMedrash, Teirosa is nase kroin kroin. His Teira becomes torn to pieces. Hard to give it a different word. Kroin kroin means torn pieces. It's hard to understand both equations, both parts of this Chazal. Chazal are telling me, first of all, what exactly is the specific problem of the falling asleep? L'mashal, there are things that you're not allowed to do in a Beis Medrash because it's a bizayin. Depends what type of Beis Medrash, depends what type of Kedusha. There are things that a Talmud Chacham, who this is his place, has more of a right. The different activities that fall under the category of Bizoyan, a person should ideally not use this medrash for any Divrei Chayil. So what is it about being misnamne, falling asleep, that is bad? It even implies, misnamne implies that it's not your fault. You fell asleep. A person eats. He makes a conscious decision, I'm eating. A person schmoozes, he makes a conscious decision, I'm schmoozing. A person falls asleep, he fell asleep. And of all the activities that we could consider, it's probably it's the most neutral. In other words, when a person is eating and drinking Beis Medrash, he's doing something. He's doing a pa'ula, he's doing a ma'isa. But when a person is sleeping, he's not doing anything. So it's a kind of neutral area. So first of all, what is this misnam name about? Why is misnam name, what is especially bad about misnam? What are Chazal picking on misnam name for? Secondly, what does it mean, Torah says nasa kroin kroin? What quality, what negative quality are we expressing about Torah that we're calling it kroin kroin? The Chavetz Chaim actually, in Chaim Hadas, gives a bit of a mashal that for every person, there's like a beged. The Torah that he learns is a beged in Olam Haba. And if it's nasa kroin kroin, it's like a beged that's ripped. But that's also a mashal. It's a mashal that on its simplest level is meant to make us feel that, you know, it's a rahmanis, it's bad, it's not good. But is there something specific? Chazal didn't just throw out these things kind of crying, crying, and it's like imagine walking with a ripped beged. Yes, it's bad. But how does it translate into a ruchnistic world? What exactly bad does it translate? So I'd like to try to possibly think through something over here. If you take a look at fancy cloth sheets, I know, for instance, there's a number for how many threads per square inch, something along those lines. Now, so let's say we have, I don't know, 100 threads per square inch. I have no idea what the norm is and what's fancy, whatever it is. But let's say, so a person makes a cheshbon that in this sheet there are 1,000 threads. Now, someone tells me, you know what? I'd like you to buy me sheets, and I'm kind of a fancy person. I want 1,000 threads per square inch sheets. Now, I come back, and I couldn't find any one of them. And I have two choices. So I have to bring back something. I can bring back sheets that are 100 threads per square inch, and I can bring back a big pack of thousands and thousands of threads. So I'll come back with a big pack of 1,000 thousands of threads, and probably it'll be thrown in my face. Because a sheet is not threads. It's made of threads, but it takes on a metzius of its own, and it becomes a sheet. Now, threads, more threads per sheet is an increase in quality, but we're dealing with the same object. So 100 threads per square inch is poorer quality, but it's a sheet. 10,000 threads are not sheets. They're threads. It has no shaykhs to it. In other words, when I have something that's made of parts, and those parts are integrated in a way in which they create the whole, that is a davashon, that's a thing. There's quality in how much, and this, and so on and so forth. When we think of Torah, so mitzvahs, to some degree, are separate. I could put on talis and tefillin in the morning, I could chas v'shalom not bench lunchtime. It's bad, but it's not quite one unit, and so on. Torah has in itself two qualities. It has in itself a quality where every line that I learn is important. It's Torah, it's a mitzvah tam Torah. But Torah is an entity. It's a complete idea and understanding. A meseches is an entire woven tapestry. It's an entire woven beged. And if I'm missing a part of it, it's not just less threads per count, then I just don't have it. The understanding that Torah, Chazal are teaching us, that Torah has a dimension of being an entire inyan. And if I'm missing part of the inyan, I'm not just missing one piece of information, I don't have an entire inyan. So if somebody can explain to me let's say I ask somebody, how does a computer work? If he knows 80% of it, he still doesn't know how a computer works. Because how it gets from the input to the processing, if he has no idea, then I don't know. I know many things, but I don't know how a computer works. How does Nezikin work? What is the proper responsibilities of a person towards someone else when he damages it? There are different halachas, and then there's the understanding of my responsibility towards damaging somebody. Torah itself, yes, every word we learn and every line we know is an important yediyah. Those are yediyahs. But Torah is also an entirety of an understanding. So Chazal pick Misnam name Dafka. You're right. When a person falls asleep, there is not over here an Avera per se, but at the end of the day, the different thoughts and ideas are disconnected. There's a disconnect. So he has one idea and another idea and another idea, but in no way are they connected. My Rebbe Reb Nachum Schein of Racha was, when I came to Israel in Tavshin Lamed in 1970, he started getting sick. He had multiple sclerosis. He went to America and they asked Reb Chaim Shmulevitz to say the shir instead of him. Reb Chaim was older, his father-in-law. Reb Chaim was a goy in Olam. Reb Chaim Shurim were world famous. But he had tremendous admiration for Reb Nachum. And he expressed it very interesting. He said, no one can give Reb Nachum shir. He said, a big Talmud Chacham knows many points on a Daf Gemara. A huge Talmud Chacham knows many more points. By Reb Nachum, the points flow together. He doesn't say many chidushim on a daf. The entire daf comes together. That was the way he expressed it. It was a very interesting perspective on what it means, that type of perspective on Torah. So Chazal are telling us that Torah itself, that they picked on something which is not a bad thing in itself. They picked on something not where you're missing something. So if a person is sitting and talking while the shiur is going on, he's missing a piece. If a person is sitting and learning his misnamnim, he seems to pick off where he left off, but he's not. It's nasa kroin kroin, it becomes pieces, pieces. Pieces, pieces, even if you have all the pieces, a suit cut into six pieces is not a six-piece suit. It's shmatis, the rags, that's all it is. I saw the Imi Emes, he was the Ger Rebbe, this Fas Emes' son. He says a very fascinating chat. It says in the beginning of Chayesara, it says, Vayu Imi Chayesara Mea Shana Vesem Shana, Beshev Shana. So he puts together two Medrashim. It says, Rabbi Akiva was darshening Vatsiba Misnamneim, and people started nodding off. Exactly what we're talking about. Bikish la'ira. So he wanted to wake them up. And he said, Maros Esther Shema Hashem Esther Mea Medina, Alatova Esther, there was Rabbas Peter Shal Sora, and she has Mea Esther Mesheva Medinas. So the Rebbe Kiva wanted to wake up people that were sleeping, and he told them this, that Keneged, the 127 years that Sarah lived, that's where Esther 127. So he stoles it through to the next medrash, to the medrash before. It says, Vayu chayisori me'er bezen shana, yodea Hashem yimei t'mimim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, HaKadosh Baruch Hu acknowledges the days of people that are shleimim, tamim eshalim, ukeshem shein t'mimim, kach shnoisen t'mimim. Bas Essing, Bas Sheva, Bas Meik, Bas Esrim, and so on. So, in other words, Reb Akiva was trying to point to the same phenomenon of Shlemus. He wanted to wake people up, and this was his way of explaining, of sort of telling of this Gemara about what you lose out when you misnamne. You lose out this Shlemus Hayamim, And in the Shleimus HaYomim, we get the Shleimus HaMalchus. A Malchus is one entity. United States of America is not 50 states. It is one entity that's comprised of 50 states. Me'ev Esen V'Sheva, the Malchus of Me'ev Esen V'Sheva means these are 127 different and distinct countries, and together there's one Malchus, which is that Malchus. And that's because there was Tmimus and so on. I'd like to apply it to this program and try to... I want to point out something about the time factor, and I want to point out something about the learning itself. The getting used to the idea, the big change between being someone who learns to someone who's a lamdan, in the full sense of the word, is the perspective. If you're teaching a word, teaching a sentence, hearing a kasha, giving a teretz, you're learning, and that's good. But that's not the perspective of Torah. The perspective of Torah is there's a sugya. There's a whole sugya, and the sugya has to flow. If the beginning doesn't connect to the end mentally, if you don't see how the sugya got from A to B, if you don't understand how the Rishonim got to where they got to, if you don't see it as a davar shalem, then it's very, very hard for you to really understand it. And it's very hard to get that if the learning is stop and go, stop and go, stop and go, because you visualize it that way. So in terms of the quality of being a lamdan, like we spoke about Reb Nachum, that way of Chaim and the mind of Nachum, but even to learn a sugya, Shas consists of sugya. A sugya consists of an entire weave of different kashas, teretz, maskanas, and so on. This is also true in terms of memorization. And I want to give, it's something which when you think about it, it makes so much sense. Let's say, how smart do you have to be to memorize the names of 5,000 parts, 5,000 distinct mechanical, electronic pieces, their names, their functions, etc. You have to be quite bright to memorize that. Or let's say they have to have at least a very good memory for that. But if somebody knows a car, somebody's a car mechanic, he would know that amount of parts and pieces. And the reason is because it's not a random list of parts and pieces. He understands a car. And this is where the gas has to come in. This has to filter the gas. This has to mix it with the air. Mm-hmm. This has to spark it. This has to put pressure this way. This needs to be able to interrupt it and say, because it connects as a car, all the pieces are understood as part of it. And that's why it's not difficult to remember it, because you see it as part of one thing. I know a car, I live a car, I see a car. Now, I understand the pieces because they all fit into that picture. One of the mnemonic devices for remembering random things is one of the most common famous tricks is to make a story out of it. So usually pick a very funny story and you take 25 random items and you somehow put it together. It's not just a trick. It's because you're able to put the things, it becomes one thing to remember, not 100 items. You're remembering one thing, and the more the story comes together, the easier to remember it, because you're remembering one thing. That one thing now breaks down to subparts which you can remember. So having that type of a memory, having that type of a knowledge of Torah, the more the Torah is integrated, and you see something as an entire sugya, it's something fascinating. If you learn a half of an inyan, whether it's shulchan aruch or whatever, it's usually harder to remember than an entire inyan. Because if you remember the entire inyan, all the pieces click together, they fit together. If you know halachas, then you have to remember a lot of parts, and that's excruciatingly difficult. So in terms of getting down the what you're learning and knowing it, is also very valuable. So a program like this gives you a certain shlemus, your own sense of learning becomes much more shalem, and your understanding improves qualitatively, and you're able to increase that knowledge. I want to finish with a thought that Chaim Shlevitz used to say often. Rebbe Akiva left home to go learn. 12 years he wasn't home. He comes home, Chazal says, the Gemara says, he heard his wife telling a neighbor that if he'd listen to me, he'd stay another 12 years. He didn't bother to say hello, he went back. So Chaim asked, why couldn't he just say hello? Like, why? And his answer was, 12 and 12 is not 24. And the mashal he used was, if you're cooking a pot on an oven, on a stove, if it boils, it's boiled water forever. And you know, whatever quality boiled water has, if it's free of any bacteria or whatever, it's good. If you cook it 5 minutes, let it cool down, 5 minutes cool down, 5 minutes cool down, it never becomes boiled. Because some things require just an entire process. And disrupting the process starts all over again. So he would speak about hafsakas in learning. In my days, it wasn't even common to go every year to America. When I came to Israel, once in 2 years was the common thing for Pesach. It was very, very expensive, and just that's the way it was. But as an approach to learning, Baruch Hashem, Yezocha, to be in a Mokum Torah, I'm sure part of the bracha of Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to America, Torah, is the type of total immersion and integration that's possible. It's up to us to make the most of it. The less hefsik we have, the less misnamne. So if a person has a choice of learning 5 hours with interruptions or 4 hours uninterrupted, you might have to ask a posik about Hilchas Talmud Torah, but certainly from a learning perspective, 4 hours uninterrupted is qualitatively a different world. And hopefully the program will be a spark plug. It'll start something. Because, like I said, what distinguishes Talmud Torah from being another Maisa Mitzvah that you're doing many Maisa Mitzvahs to something with a very different perspective, something that sort of is a whole integrated understanding of something, is this quality. Bez Hashem, it's something to use, and I'm sure once you get a taste of what it feels like to forget things and just submerge yourself in learning and be uninterrupted, the type of understanding and knowledge is sugya afterwards, I'm sure Bez Hashem, you'll have cheshek to continue to fight and fight Bez Hashem. Batzlacha.
Yeah.
I guess it comes with some perks being ahead of him, I said.
So I asked the Rebbe before, and there's a bit of a controversy, but discussion. We discussed in one of the sikhot about what's going on in yeshivas and those that are really, really stagnant and those that are perhaps struggling more. So I know Rosh Hashiva mentioned he's actually publishing an article on the topic. So I asked Rabbi if he could give us a little bit of some insight into that topic.
So I guess it's the remarks I make is not what I wrote. It's simply because a question is answered, it's addressed by someone, it's answered by someone. I guess the klal gadol is that, let's give an example. If a person is going to a college and he finds out that the college degree is not terribly valued in the marketplace, so what does he do? So let's give two choices. One choice is he takes it to his employer, his hopeful employer. Employer says, college X is worth nothing. And the guy says, it's their fault, a bunch of losers, good, do nothings, really bad place. Or B, he goes to a different college. The problem is, when it would come to something like college, if there's a problem, we might angry, we might curse, we might do whatever we would do. We would roll up our sleeves and make sure we do what we need to do. There's a subconscious sense that it's really doing it for Hashem, and if I can have a really good excuse, then Hashem has to take it. You know, a note written by my rabbi, it's got to go to Hashem. It was my yeshiva's fault. Well, that type of thinking tends to be used when you really just need an excuse. If it's something relevant, like what college you're going to get, you're going to ask yourself, what does the employer want? The question is being addressed to us as yeshiva bachurim. Then we need to ask ourselves, how and what will make me grow the belt most? If I'm really interested in becoming a Talmud Chacham Ben Torah, and I know what a Talmud Chacham Ben Torah looks like, then A, I will look for a yeshiva that will bring it out in me. B, I will mind my business what I need to do. When a person reads a point made that he felt he shouldn't do a good job, then the reaction for someone who's still in yeshiva should be, A, what can I do to maximize my time? Do I feel not maximizing my time and I should do it? And B, maybe there's a place that does better with me. You know, it's to sit, the shifting of the blame or placing blame, right or wrong. But I'm saying in terms of us as yeshiva bachurim, we should ask ourselves, well, what can I do to make it happen? That's what I want to. Yes?
This week's parasha, when the Kodesh Baruch Hu says, Shalom Aleichem to Moshe Rabbeinu, I think maybe some of the Talmidim here think it's a Maisa of a Simul Labanim, in terms of the way that they're dressed. So I was wondering if maybe the Rosh Hashiva could speak about Tzuras HaAdam when it comes to dress for Yom Torah.
So let's reframe the question a little bit, and let's make it sharper. You know, do we really care about externalities or not? Do we really care about externalities? You know, like, why is that important to us? That's a very righteous question, kind of. Everyone feels good about that approach. So let's take a simple example. Imagine you had a lot of money to invest. You had millions of dollars to invest. And someone has a sign up. I'm an investment banker. You come in. The guy is wearing a rumpled pair of shorts, an old T-shirt, and hasn't shaved in a day or two. Would you be comfortable investing with him? Probably not. There's a reason why a banker looks the way he looks. There's a reason why when you walk into a courtroom, you expect the judge to look formal. So whether he should wear a wig or not, depends if you're English. But you definitely don't want him to look like the guy filling gas next door. Why not? Externalities are nothing. The answer is, it's not true. Externalities are a message we send. If you're dating somebody, and the person looks like they put no effort into dressing for you, it's a message. We express ourselves in certain ways. There's a reason why we dress one way at a place that we want to act very casual. Another place we want to act very formal. There's a reason why they're different. These are ways of expressing ourselves. My many years ago, my children took a trip with a family from Hutzar, it's a very good friend of ours, and there was a busload of people, and one of the, so most yeshiva type people, they were one or two people, not, and one of the people davened for the Amid in a pair of shorts. They stopped somewhere davened. Minchin davened shorts. My son, who was a young boy at the time, not a very big tzaddik, but a big mouth, said to him something along the lines of chutzpah, whatever it is. The guy said, where does it say you can't daven like that? So my son told him, this fellow used to work for the prime minister doing speech writing. He was a very successful person. So my son asked him, would you show up in the prime minister's office like this? And to his credit, the person thought a minute and he said, you're right. I'm never going to daven this way again. I'm going to be dressed eventually. You would think it's a chutzpah if somebody wants to walk into the prime minister's office. It's just been the Knesset people used to wear anything. They made a dress code because it changes the atmosphere. So the person expresses himself through how he presents himself. And that's why, so exactly what color the hat a yarmulke should be, is that a big difference? But the difference is formal, informal, outrageous, however you want to describe it, the different ways of presenting yourself and establishing a certain level of presentation. It's in halachas of davening, dress is one of them. It's called ikon l'kasher makecha, prepare yourself. If you can walk into HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way off the street, then somebody, this I heard from somebody who learned America's Arab, at a neighbor of mine, very fine person. He said, America's Arab, serving the army is a noble duty. You're protecting Klal Yisrael against Yisrael, and they had their own arrangement. But he said somebody walked in straight from duty into the Beis Medrash. Rav Tzvi Yehuda told him, "Don't walk in with your muddy boots into the Beis Medrash." I don't think he meant literally. I think he meant yes, in the trenches you're doing a tremendous mitzvah. But a Beis Medrash needs to have a breathing space. It says that a person should build a Beis Medrash, it says delos between delos, like you have an outer foyer and then inner, because you first have to come out off the street and then come into the Beis Medrash. So a level of presentation that makes you realize I am now learning Torah, I'm now davening, is significant. Yeah.
What about...
Represent, what's your name? Where are you from? Just...
Asher Lieberman. I'm from Hillside, New Jersey. I went to JDC.
Yeah.
What about eating in the Beis Medrash and otherwise other things that might be acceptable and not acceptable to do in the Beis Medrash?
So again, in Halacha, there are a few points about it. There is leeway for Tamir Chum. It's called, that's the home. But I think it's appropriate. So it's appropriate that a person only do what he has to do. So drinking water or coffee or tea, then okay, you know what, it's something you need. Do you need to eat a meal in the Beis Medrash? It takes away from the Beis Medrash. So there's a place to make guidelines for tzibur, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Yes?
Should the person feel bad if the only time in his life he's ever going to do it, have that shleimus of learning is this week and a half, right? And that's the only time he's ever going to have hours upon hours. Most people are not going to have the chance to do that, really. So is one time really enough? He's probably not going to do it the rest of his life.
You know, everything is always, you can say something about the year of learning here, 2 years of learning or whatever. But if a person at least understands what you're accomplishing, it serves as a certain marker. I want to tell you something. The Mi Yeshiva has, and it's been the last dozen years or so, they've had Yarche Kala programs in the middle of the winter. It's more the beginning winter, it's like Thanksgiving's time, because that's the easiest, where people come in for 4 or 5 days of learning, full day learning in Yeshiva. People who had learned Yeshiva on today, business or professions, whatever, and a few hundred people come. They have shurim all day long. They learn chavrusa, the iyun. And I wondered, this year, 2 or 3 of the people were actually from Silver Spring, and they told me it was a transformative experience for them, because it reconnected them to a world of learning that they weren't there. They had been there 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but you know, it's a different world. Keeping that as a certain guiding light, as a sort of a North Star, refreshing it every so often. So if a person can continue to learn strongly, that's amazing. If a person can come back to it, and touch base, its value lies at least in providing a point of reference to what you can do and the tremendous time of learning the fullness. Yes? What's your name?
Daniel Dresner from China. So talking about the externals and what you wear, what is your thing about wearing a black hat?
The black hat started because once upon a time that was the formal garment. If you'll take a look at pictures pre-Kennedy era, all in America, official people wore hats. In South Africa, even much later, you could see, you know, everyone wearing hats. You'd think, wow, what a yeshivish looking government. So in the yeshivas, it remained the way a shtreimel remained, the way a kapata remained. It's being part of a tzibur, that's all. In my world, not wearing a hat is a statement of informality. In other worlds, it doesn't exist. I think everyone has to, these are the things that are really relevant. What does it mean in your society? If you live in Senegal, a long flowing gold robe marks chashivas. In America, it means you're nuts. You know, it's a certain expression. So there's a context for it. And that's why to tell somebody who's in a society who's going back to put on a black hat, because Kedusha will come with a black hat, that's absurd. If somebody is in a yeshiva community is not wearing a black hat, the question is, what's it all about? That's really what it depends on. Yes, what's your name?
Yoram Gertzberg.
Gertzberg? Yes. Jonathan Gertzberg is your uncle? Oh, wow. It's a former alumni yeshiva. See, we even get nephews of alumni yeshiva coming.
So, Rebbe's known for being interested in science. So, how does Rebbe toe the line between scientific advancement versus Torah when they're juxtaposed, or scientific advancement comes out and says this part of the Torah isn't necessarily fact, or how do you pick, obviously you stick with the Torah, but how do you navigate what you take away from
this? It's a long topic, it's a broad topic, but in general there's no such thing, and I want to explain just one point. Science, if you stick to a strict definition of what science is and properly should be, is the facts on the ground, meaning that it's day outside is a fact, that if the sun is shining it's 5 degrees warmer than if the sun is not shining is a fact. I measured once, twice, 100 times, and that's a metzius. What happened a year ago, and I find stuff, that's evidence. So Sherlock Holmes is not a scientist. He's creating a scenario which is probable. He can never say what happened, and you see a lot of crimes, now especially, a lot of crimes that seem to have been judged, people judged guilty, they've been freed, hundreds of people, because even though evidence strongly pointed in a certain direction, it was evidence, and it was wrong. It's like poor Sherlock Holmes sitting and finding 2 strands and a spat and building a beautiful story out of it, and then somebody finds the camera that was recording. Science cannot tell you what happened 5,000 years ago. It can tell you about things that are and extrapolate. Some of it seems very reasonable, but it's very different than telling me that if I light up oil to a certain temperature, this will happen. The same thing is true with psychology. I can tell you facts, which things will get a person more to do this or to do that, but to tell me that a person doesn't have it in him to overcome, so science tends to exceed its exact limits. Exact limits should be a fact. Science can tell you what is. Science can tell you a probable of what was, but it's only a probable. And the further we go back, the more it's a guess. So therefore, that part of science to me doesn't even feel as science. It's simply, it's projecting. It's also starting with something, and I want to add another point. It's not a topic. It's a topic that deserves well its own thing. But every science book that deals with history of the world, beginning of the world, evolution, starts with a sentence. It's not written a sentence, but it starts with an unwritten sentence. If there is no intelligent creator, then this must be the scenario. There's no way science can deal with the Mitzvah HaGashmak. And someone told me, his name is Professor Danishevsky, he's a big biochemist. I was speaking to him about something, and his great-grandfather was actually a very chashuv rav, was less rav, I think, of less of a Slabodka, but he said that his wife, he and his wife were attending some lecture, some convention by a chemist, and the person lecturing was explaining how a certain critical molecule exists in a way that almost defies probability. And then, so his wife, like, sort of very instantly, right, so said, so I guess it must have been designed to fit it. And he said, obviously. And then the person caught himself and he left. And he said, oh, well, you know, we're not going there. But you know, it's so science starts with a very unscientific point. Barring an outside creator, science can't deal with a creator. And I understand that. But therefore, science should be limited to the here and now. Does this vaccine work or not? Science belongs there. Because I can take 1,000 people, vaccinate them, expose them, and see yes or no. But when it starts telling me what was, then they're using what evidence to build something, but the word science shouldn't exist over there. And again, it's a long topic, it's a broad topic. It's something that needs, but just you raised the point, so I wanted to address it. Yeah. Okay.
What should be the balance between investing one's time in learning, talking about a guy who's capable of learning like full time, certainly like a good part of the day, and engaging in other activities such as studying other intellectual areas, broadening your horizons, etc. I'm talking about not just like for practical reasons, but for the very sake of picking up more knowledge and understanding the world better. From her perspective, what should be the balance between these two time-wise and also in terms of investing your effort in general?
So there have been differences of approach, of opinion. The Rishonim seem to have been conversant with what was general knowledge. Hard sometimes know exactly, it's hard to know what was available, how much, but they definitely were conversing with it. Somewhere like the Gra, except for certain areas, was very, very knowledgeable in it. Others you don't find. This seems to be a sense, you know, it's less Mandapalik, that knowing it, the Tanya mentions it very briefly in one of his early parakim, that if a person is using it to understand Darkei Hashem better, because everything has to be with a perspective of why am I doing it. So sometimes a person has a natural need. A person who's a musician has a natural need to play, a natural need to understand music. A person who is intellectually curious has some natural need to understand the world around him. There's also an inyan that I see HaKadosh Baruch Hu in many different ways, and I see how he manifests himself in the world. So a person should be using a balance between ikur, the content of Torah, the essence of Torah is the ikur, and these are branches of it. The Gemara, the Mishnah speaks about, you know, things that are gufei, you know, halachis, things that are papiros lechachma. So reaching some balance of knowing Torah's core versus understanding how it branches and leaves out needs a person to make that balance. It's hard to give any clear, but again, a person, there are people who have a natural need for it, like a musician has a need for music. And there are chachamim who felt that this was appropriate, some more, some less. Maybe one more question, yeah. One more question, we have to go, yeah.
Speaking of the last one.
I don't want to interrupt the learning. I mean, this is, you know, it's going to be all misnam name and no, yeah.
What answer would Rabbi give to guys who find, like, struggle, yeah, myself included, definitely this past week has been highlighting this particular, like, struggle, like, staying focused, like, you know, maybe every few minutes, like I'll think of something else, I'll wander up, and 5 minutes goes by, and you know, why don't you go off tomorrow? Like, what answer would Rabbi give?
So it is the struggle of everybody learning. Very, very few people are born glued to a Gemara. Believe it or not, many people at least learning Basmata Rabbah had the same struggle, come at everybody. I say just a few things. First of all, knowing that as time goes on, you get better at it. You know, it's giving up and keeping on beating up on yourself for is not an answer. Two, the more you can be expressive in the learning, if you're learning yourself, you say out the words, you think the question through in your mind, you're learning with a chavrusa, the more you're engaging some physical parts of yourself, the less likely you are to wander off. One of the reasons why we wander off so badly is because 95% of us is not engaged in learning. It's very hard to sit in one place, put you on the most comfortable couch and tell you to sit here. That's something that's very difficult. If you're doing something, it's much easier to stand and swim in a pool because all of your body is engaged in it. You can do that until you just simply fatigue. So if you're learning and you're active in it, you speak out the kasha with your mouth, you think through the kasha instead of just kind of being passive about it, those are things that are helpful. And just the knowledge that as you get into it, things begin to snap into place, you begin to think about it. It's you begin to understand the bigger picture, and then you try to run the whole thing through your mind. So learning in an active way, not paying attention to the fact that it's still not going the way you want to, and with the knowledge and the hope that it makes a shame in time, things will change. Okay,
thank
it's been
very
a very, very special, and a lot of